Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. Linda Santos has her work cut out for her as the newly appointed director of the Honolulu Zoo, which lost its Association of Zoos and Aquariums accreditation in March of 2016. Some 10% of American zoos win AZA accreditation, and getting it back is going to be a top priority. She's with us in our studio. Hi, Linda, and congratulations on the new job.
Thank you, Chris, and it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And this is the culmination of quite a few years at that very facility, right?
Yes, over 30 years working there at the Honolulu Zoo.
I want to, you know, the whole idea of loss of accreditation has that sort of ominous sound, but yet it isn't given to that many zoos, right?
Right. There's only 200 and maybe 30-something zoos that actually have been accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
And just to be clear, it was based on their lack of feeling of assurance of a steady revenue stream. Is that an accurate description?
Yes. They want to see some accuracy of, like, stable funding. And it was also the roles of all the different entities that ran the zoo, mm-hmm. the governing authority. Clearly, we needed to define the roles of all the partners, the Zoological Society, our concessionaire, governing authority, and zoo director.
So some concern about who decides what?
Yeah, so who's running what portion of the zoo, who has a say in what? Mm-hmm. Everyone has great ideas, and I think it was just getting all those ideas into sort of one room and one package and how to move forward with mm-hmm. all that.
So that's obviously your task, getting it back. And what kind of things are you going to do that?
So, you know, one is we need a new memorandum of agreement with our nonprofit, and the governing authority has this administration has been very supportive of the zoo mm-hmm. and, you know, looking at how we're going to get accreditation. They're very interested, and our nonprofit has been very interested in, you know, getting accreditation as well. So
sure.
I think the focus, the zoo is in a good place, and everyone has a focus, and we're working together as a team mm-hmm. To meet the goal. So we'll put our best foot forward when the time comes.
One of the things that you and I were talking about a little bit earlier, just talking before the show, is how much zoos have changed over the 30 years you've been in the business. How have they changed?
They have changed drastically. So, you know, when you come to a zoo now, it's more educational and based on conservation. So zoos have designed exhibits so that the animals are, it's so to speak, not in these barred cages.
Yeah.
Those were the old zoos. And today, you know, exhibits look more naturalistic and, you know, there's enrichment at it. So you don't have the pacing bear and, you know, that kind of stuff. So
because I have a childhood memory from the Central Park Zoo of a pacing panther who clearly was, you know, had behavioral problems resulting from being caged.
Yeah.
It seems as if it took a long time for that to be understood.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of research and studies that went on about animal welfare. Mm-hmm. And the thought was if you were going to have animals in captivity, then you need to treat them right.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
So are we in a pretty good place vis-a-vis that now?
Yeah, the concern for AZ was never about animal welfare.
Right.
And, you know, our staff works really hard, and they're very dedicated, and they take really good care of our animals.
Yeah. Well, it also seems as if you have some real repeat visitors, because we sort of put out a call over the weekend to listeners mm-hmm. to have questions for you. And frankly, I thought if somebody was going to ask about the accreditation and, you know, the things that have been in the paper. Instead, they're very specific questions about from people who clearly know what's going on at the zoo. Is the Malaysian sun bear exhibit completed?
So the Malaysian sun bear exhibit is not completed. The bid went out. We just awarded it to a contractor. Mm-hmm. And so the exhibit is actually now part of the reptile and amphibian complex. So as you go through the reptile and amphibian complex, you'll come up to the Malaysian sun bear, and uh-huh. we're modernizing it so that there's a nice glass viewing window that guests can actually see the bear. So that's going to start being worked on real soon.
Well, here's another question. Just to give an example of the kind of questions we got, are meerkats back on exhibit?
Yes, our meerkats are back on exhibit. They've been on exhibit for a while, and the only time we take them off is when they're doing some work in the exhibit, cleaning and...
Well, you know, when I looked at these questions, Linda, what they said to me was, loyalty and repeat visits, right?
Yes. We have a lot of repeat visitors. We have people who are members, obviously. And we also have visitors that come from the mainland that tend to visit the zoo every year.
Uh-huh.
You know, they come back and...
How do you get feedback from them? You know, do you have a little questionnaire?
Yeah,
that you give them?
You know, anyone's welcome to fill out a comment card at the front ticket booth area, and mm-hmm. you know, we read those and we take all the comments and concerns into consideration. So it's great to see all the things that people like or don't like about the zoo, because it makes us better.
And you sort of keeping a feedback loop up like that, you want to also know things like percentages of, percentages of Kama'aina visitors. Do you have a way of keeping track of that?
Right now, we really don't. Well, we do by what they pay at the ticket gate.
Right.
So every day we know how many Kama'ainas came in by what they paid to come in, because the Kama'aina rate's a little less than the general admission.
Mm-hmm.
So we can keep track of it that way, and our visitors...
It'd be interesting to compare, yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting. We do get a lot of mixed seasonal type guests as well.
Oh, sure.
So you see, a flux of different visitors depending on the time of the year and the season.
So it sounds as if your task regarding the accreditation is giving some assurance of consistent funding, right?
Yes.
That the city is behind you.
Exactly.
And also, it sounds as if a little bit of streamlining of administration.
Yes.
Chains of command.
Yeah.
Accurate to say?
That's very accurate to say. So, you know, everyone has the zoo's best interests in mind. And I think it was to get everybody in the room and to focus. And instead of everyone asking or telling the zoo, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do.
Right.
I think it's more where we want people to say, how can we help?
Yeah.
And what should we focus on? And with those efforts, you can make huge strides, because instead of arguing about whose idea is the best,
right.
Everyone has the same goal and focus moving forward.
Makes a lot of sense, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for coming in. It's good to meet you.
Thank you.
Linda Santos has worked for the Honolulu Zoo for more than 31 years. Started in 1986 as a trainee in the bird section, worked as an animal keeper from 86 to 2008, a bird specialist from 2008 to 2011, and as the zoo's general curator from 2012 to 2015. Served as the zoo's assistant zoo director since July of 2015, and now she's the executive director.
Could be walking around a zoo with the sun shining down over me and you, and there'll be love in the bodies of the elephants too. And I'll put my hands over your eyes, but you'll peek through and there'll be sun.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Opera Theater. The new season opens with Bizet's Carmen on stage October 13th, 15th, and 17th at the Blaisdell. Tickets at hawaiiopera.org or 808-596-7858.
The person who came up with the word genocide said a classic example was the 1933 famine in Ukraine, orchestrated by Stalin. On the next Fresh Air, Anne Applebaum talks about her new book, Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine. And we'll talk about current Russian interference in elections. She helps run an election monitoring project at the London School of Economics. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after On Point.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the mixed messages of a slut walk. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about what looks like a bridge to nowhere. It casts a shadow over the Likelike Highway on the cusp of town. There are no signs on it, and it's often covered in graffiti. The bridge had to be built in 1959 after the then territory of Hawaii refused to build an entrance to the already existing private property in Kalihi Valley as plans moved forward to build the current Likelike Highway. Governor William Quinn originally intended to build the Mauka entrance using federal funding, but only if the city of Honolulu built a matching entrance on the Makai side. When the city said it had no intention of building a Makai entrance, Governor Quinn abandoned the project and the bridge was built instead. This concrete bridge became a crime scene in the 1960s when detectives attempted to get some photos of one of the residents and trespassed on private property. They were met by the property owner who pulled a shotgun and killed one of the detectives. The overpass is named after the family that owned the now-abandoned property, and this morning we're looking for its name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Vukan Vucic, Emeritus Professor of Transportation Systems Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. You are listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Whose interests are served by a so-called slut walk, a parade of women in exaggeratedly revealing outfits with the stated purpose of changing public attitudes toward rape? Rape victims are often shamed for the way they were dressed when they were attacked, and a slut walk is designed as a deliberate provocation, a way to shake up the culture. Catherine Jean, Executive Director of the Pacific Alliance Against Slavery, has worked with rape and human trafficking victims for years. And as plans advance for a Honolulu slut walk, we're asking for her take on a volatile subject. She's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. I can't wait to hear what your take is on this idea. Is there a good idea at the heart of this in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the slut walk nationally was started by a college student who was a rape survivor and basically calling out slut shaming. And that's
the whole idea of asking for it. If you're in a rape trial, the victim is inevitably going to be asked, how were you dressed at
exactly,
the time?
Exactly, which
attack?
Is ridiculous and re-victimizing. However, the Hawaii slut walk was quickly changed in its mission due to some supporters such as J20 and Amnesty International's Hawaii chapter, which is a small group of a few volunteers, to actually promote a pro-pimping bill, which is technically dormant yet will be reintroduced automatically next year, HB 1533. And that's where we came into the picture. Because this bill was so harmful and dangerous, we were quite shocked that the slut walk had inherited this new mission to decriminalize pimping.
Well, the bill is the language of the bill obviously doesn't say we're going to decriminalize pimping. How do they?
Yeah, it does.
Really?
It
how do
does.
They phrase it?
So what's more telling about the bill, if you are used to reading bills, is not what is written so much as what is crossed out.
Not.
Yeah, and so what is crossed out are a lot of reforms to the Promoting Prostitution Code that we worked on for several years to make it very victim-centered and go after pimps and johns who are the culprits of this illegal sex trade in a very serious way.
Abettors of...
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so what this bill does would be to legalize sex tourism, which we were the first state in the nation to make that illegal. Mm-hmm. Other states have modeled their laws against sex tourism after ours. Mm-hmm. And it would also legalize pimping, which would, in the bill, deletes everything about promoting prostitution of the, in the second first degree, which is very troubling. Because if you can't prove force, fraud, or coercion, which is very challenging to prove in court, you have the second degree, the promoting prostitution offense, mm-hmm. right? Which is you still get that pimp for a Class B felony, which is a pretty serious offense with some pretty heavy jail time. The third thing that HB 1533 does would make it legal again for police to have sex with prostituted persons under the guise of an investigation. And that's something that hit national and even international news when we were responsible for making that change and making it illegal for them to do that.
Well, Kathy, I go back to my original question. Whose interests are served?
Well, unfortunately, we have a global pro-pimp movement that pretends to be victim-centered and hides behind the vernacular and the slogans behind survivors who are prostituted persons. And this pro-pimp movement has unfortunately hit Hawaii shores. Globally, the movement is funded by the likes of people like George Soros. It's a very serious movement.
Well, because the rhetoric I've seen, I first noticed this in the Village Voice, mm-hmm. A series of articles that essentially said that these are sex workers, leave them, the kids hanging out by the Lincoln Tunnel, mm-hmm. At the lowest level of, street prostitution. Kids hanging out by the Lincoln Tunnel, pulling up to cars and things, are independent sex workers, leave them alone, they have a right to use their own bodies the way they want to, et cetera, et cetera. That's the kind of rhetoric that is.
Yeah, and it's all lies and
well, it takes the pimp and the coercion
right.
out of the picture.
Yeah.
You've seen your fair share of that, right?
What the pro-pimp movement here and globally has to do in order to further their agenda to decriminalize pimping under the guise of decriminalizing prostitution is two things. First, they have to convince the public and lawmakers that pimps are benign, nonviolent business necessities, which is completely a fabrication.
Honest brokers.
Right, which is absurd.
Yeah.
And secondly, they have to minimize rape or redefine it altogether as something that's really not so a big thing.
This is getting back to the, wasn't she kind of asking for it?
Even more so, even more so. Heavily traumatized prostituted persons that have been in the game for so long and have become perpetrators themselves have actually honestly redefined rape, some of them, to say that they don't feel that they were raped unless the John doesn't pay them. Now, we don't want society to get to that point.
Yeah.
That is absolutely not where we want to go legislatively or even in any sort of social credo. And so when this happened with the Slut March here in Hawaii, the Slut Walk, I did my due diligence to reach out to their supporters, such as I saw the Women's March as one of the main supporters. And I called their head, the chair, Sherry Campagna, and I said, do you understand what decriminalization of prostitution is? Do you understand what's in HB 1533? And she said, no. And this was actually familiar to me because these organizers have done this kind of thing before. They have pushed an agenda through a popular event and not really told their sponsors and supporters really what's involved in decriminalizing prostitution.
You mentioned Amnesty International earlier, mm-hmm. which would not come to mind as supporting what you described.
Right. So Amnesty International actually promotes the decriminalization of prostitution. But what the general public does not know is that they were infiltrated by a sex trafficker who was convicted for sex trafficking, but before that had encouraged and succeeded in encouraging Amnesty International to redefine sex work to include also not just the victims, but the pimps and brothel owners.
Because it baffles me that liberals of the Amnesty International stripe would get caught into this. You know, it seems like a kind of a woolly-headed.
Yeah, liberalism. They just don't know. They just don't know any better, and they fell victim to the lies and agendas of the pro-pimp movement. Same thing happened with the UN. They recruited the largest brothel owner in the UK to encourage them to change their policies about decriminalization. And now that when you say sex work, that you have to know that also includes the perpetrators of the crime, not just the victims, right? So that changes the entire agenda for decriminalizing prostitution. Now, when I talked to the Women's March and I talked to Sherry, she was very shocked. But she took the necessary steps, and it was very inspiring to watch her do this, to revert that mission of the slut walk back to its original, which is something that we can all agree, which is calling out slut shaming. It never should have been changed in the first place. No. Their supporters had no idea about this ulterior agenda, decriminalizing prostitution, decriminalizing pimping. And
that's, you know, that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you about this, because it seems as if there's a shared intention that got really bent somewhere along the line.
Right. And what this also says to us is that very popular movements are often used and co-opted by lesser organizations with ulterior motives, and that's something that locally our lawmakers and policymakers and leaders need to look out for. Thankfully, with the good leadership exemplified by Sherry at the Women's March, there was no harm, no foul. This all was taken care of very quickly and very acutely, accurately. So the event is something now that we support because it's back to its original mission to call out slut shaming.
Well, I have a feeling we'll be addressing this in the future, and I really thank you for coming in. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Catherine Chan is the executive director of the Pacific Alliance Against Slavery. The Honolulu Slut Walk will take place on October 14th.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dennis and Jane Noy of Aloha Noy Realty, working with clients who are downsizing and transitioning to smaller homes and retirement living. Learn more at alohanoe.net.
Since the earliest days of human contact, Hawaii has had an accidental environment, forever thrown out of balance by introduced species, both deliberate and accidental. Rats, feral pigs, any number of plant species. The list goes on. Now, an unanticipated after-effect of the March 2011 tsunami in Japan has brought almost 70 new species to the islands to further complicate an ecosystem that's already had all the complication it can handle. Civil Beat editor Patty Epler has more in today's Reality Check. Hi, Patty.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm pretty good. This is quite a story, you know. I love this term that got used in the story, ecological roulette, because that's kind of what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's great. Really, the problem seems to be all this plastic in the ocean is allowing these critters to hitch a ride over here, thousands and thousands of miles.
We've been hearing for quite a while about debris from the tsunami washing up, what is it, 6 years later? I mean, it's incredible. But because it's really the plastic debris that never decays that gives them a permanent kind of vessel to come here on, yeah?
Yeah, it's like little rafts out there in the ocean that are just swirling around, and these things are hooking onto and just making their way to the beaches here and elsewhere too, but Hawaii has a real problem.
What kind of problems is it likely to cause, say, in the near term?
So I don't think they really know what the specific problems will be, but anytime that you get that many native invasive species, it's really probably going to change the ecosystem around here. I know they're already fighting with different kinds of algae that are building up in Kaneohe Bay.
Yeah.
And DLNR has been really on top of that. So
we hear a lot about volunteer beach cleanups, and obviously there's a shared motivation among just about everybody who lives here to get rid of plastic debris and take care of the beaches. But do we have enough people either on the job or as volunteers to really address this problem?
It just doesn't seem that way. I know in this story, which was written by Nathan Eagle, one of our writers, he spoke with DLNR officials about kind of a lack of budget to really help stay on top of this. And they're hoping to get money from the legislature this coming year to try and begin to deal with it. But I know there are a lot of volunteer organizations. I believe we're going to be doing a story about one on Sand Island that has collected tons and tons of plastic and debris that has washed up just in that area. So you're right, but there's just not enough hands, I think, to take care of it all.
And Patty, I wonder how many stories we're going to be doing in the coming months that include this sentence, and we're going to be seeking funding from the legislature.
Well, that'll be everything, Chris.
Yes, I know. Chances are not everybody's going to get all they want, is what I'm thinking. Thanks very much for talking with us, Patty.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring editor Patty Epler. There's a growing feeling in Honolulu that illegal rentals are getting out of hand, with large private homes becoming, in effect, apartment buildings with extra bedrooms, wet bars, and all the facilities of a multifamily dwelling, complete with accompanying pressure on nearby parking and other facilities. The Honolulu City Council is looking at ways to get the trend under control, and Locations Hawaii realtor John Yamasato is on hand to help us sort it all out. John, thanks for coming.
Well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you here. What is the problem? Outline it for me, if you would.
Well, I think the problem really here is scarcity, right? We have a desirable good, which is housing.
Right.
And whenever you have a lack of something, there's always people who are going to think about the rules and how to bend them and move them in their favor in order to create more out of less.
Right.
And so, we have homes going up now that are possibly too big for where they're located.
Are the rules pretty bendable as they exist now?
Well, you know, we do have rules in place, and that's the thing that's funny about this legislation is that we do have rules on the books already that I think are not enforced as they were intended.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are, you know, you like the fact that they're a little lackadaisical, because there is a desire for people who have homes to want to do what they want with their property on their land.
Right.
But at the same time, once you start affecting your neighbors and the community as a whole, there definitely needs to be enforcement of the rules, and I think that's what the legislature's looking into right now.
What additional rules are they seeking now? Is it a resolution in front of the city council?
Well, you already have rules about how large of a home you can build based on the zoning of the area.
Right.
You do have rules about how many kitchens you can have based on zoning and land space and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. I think this legislation, I was kind of looking it over before I got here, they're making it just a little bit more stringent. The wording is one thing. But then also limiting people, you know, how many people can be in a home and things of that nature. So
how do you figure that out? You know,
right. So in the end, it all comes down to, how you can make all the rules you want. How do you enforce it?
Yeah.
What's funny was not funny in a haha way, but as I was waiting to come in here, I was reading an article about on the mainland. There's a new trend called tiny homes.
Right.
I don't know if you know that.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's becoming a problem. So it's almost the opposite, where instead of these super large homes, you're getting a ton of tiny homes, And people feel like that's affecting their property values.
Because there are just that many more people in your neighborhood?
Right, because now instead of one house per acre, you're just stuffing, you know, 15 tiny homes on an acre. Mm-hmm. And
now you're a city.
Right, right. And so it's not just in Honolulu, but I think in any city that's has a large population, it's just becoming a how do you plan out and expand, because the population is going to continue to grow, but do it in a way that can keep the communities functional. It's a problem, and it's one of those things. Government will typically be behind the ball because there's a very strong incentive for people to again maximize their profit or what they can pull out of a property. So they're sitting at home at night thinking about every rule and how they can benefit. And so, you know, the government's always going to be a step behind, but you know, they're trying to do something, I think.
Well, there's a very strong incentive called the mortgage.
Right. How do I pay off my mortgage, or how do I create cash flow with this property so that now I can take this and buy another property? I mean, people are very inventive. But
a lot of the time, though, people in Hawaii find themselves, for one reason or another, sitting on more house than they can handle.
That's correct. That is true. And you know, I think it's kind of nice in some circumstances where, you know, you do have a house and you do have a small rental unit on there, and, you know, you're in Manoa, you're renting it out to a student, and they can go there. At the same time, they're subsidizing your home. I don't feel like there's anything wrong with that. I think it's just a gray line of when does it become too much? When you have 15 different families living on one lot. Now you're getting excessive.
Has it gotten to that point? I mean, are there examples like that?
I think in some areas, well, I know that what I've read is 15 different rooms, you know, so I don't know if different
independence,
families.
Independence, like studio, little studio apartments.
Right. So the way these floor plans are constructed is that you have a central kitchen area, but then you just have rooms. But the way the rooms are set up, it's almost like feels like a care home than a house.
Yeah.
Right. So I really don't know how they're going to legislate and
control
that.
Somebody comes to your door and says, "I notice you got five cars parked outside your house and all these different people coming in and out," and they say, "Oh, that's just Aunt Fred visiting from the Uncle Fred visiting from the mainland. He's gone in 2 weeks." And then what are you going to do? Come back every week to check? I mean, that's where it falls into the cracks, it seems to me.
Sure. And again, at the same point, there is this issue of, you know, this is your private property, so you should be able to kind of do what you want to with your private property. But there's once you start affecting your neighbors, it becomes a problem. So it's a complicated issue. Definitely.
I'm just sort of wondering where we go from here, because you know, the thing that we addressed earlier is the whole thing of a legislative body on one side dealing with the problem by making rules, and then it's usually the enforcement side, particularly in a in the case of Honolulu, a city government that's got more than its share of things to pay for.
Yes. Yeah, and on the break we were talking about funding. Where does the funding go? You know, you need manpower to be on top of these issues, to take the calls, to go out there, to look at these things.
What department would even handle it?
I would imagine it's the building department.
Yeah.
You know, building inspector. But they already have building violations that are different than these. You know, someone adds on extra bedroom bath that they weren't supposed to, and they're in violation of building code. You know,
and that's what they're there to do.
Right, that's what they're there to do,
addressing.
But already there's probably more than that than they can handle. So, so it's getting the manpower necessary to enforce these rules.
Yeah. Well, we're just going to have to see, won't we, John?
it is going to be interesting. And we'll see how long the market stays like this and the inventory crunch. But from our perspective, it's been like this for a long time because they're just – development has been slower, and for good reason. But when you have limited housing, people are going to find a way. They want to live here. They want to come to live here. So they're going to try their best to find a way to find housing here.
Makes sense to me. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
John Yamasato is a realtor and partner at the local realty firm Locations Hawaii. And in the interest of full disclosure, Locations is a corporate underwriter of Hawaii Public Radio.
Aloha, this is Jose Fajardo, President and General Manager of Hawaii Public Radio. This past Aloha Friday afternoon, our fall fund drive came to an excellent finish. More than 2,600 individual gifts were received from every part of the Hawaiian Islands and from listeners oceans away. We are humbled by and deeply grateful for their generous financial support. To the 871 new members who joined HPR's Ohana during this drive, thank you and welcome. We look forward to seeing you at the station soon. The contributions of these members surpassed our goal of $875,000. A big mahalo to our volunteers, food donors, and our on-air guests. Over the last 10 days, we've heard from this amazing community of supporters that they count on HPR and that HPR can count on them. Now, back to the news and music that you count on.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into what we can observe in our dark island skies and what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet. As always, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips and welcoming him back now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for the planet Venus as it shines brightly in the eastern sky at dawn. Also, keep your eyes peeled for Saturn in the westerly sky in the evening. This week, the moon is waning, and that means stargazing conditions will improve towards week's end.
And we have a return to a story that we have followed over the last several years here on Stargazer, and there's apparently a new update.
Yes, it's the mystery of Tabby's star. For several years now, Tabby's star has exhibited strange dimming events, meaning that as astronomers looked at the star, its brightness appeared to decrease over time. This mysterious dimming gave rise to all sorts of theories, ranging from clouds of comets to alien megastructures in orbit around the star. Recent findings, published in the Astrophysical Journal, seem to have finally produced a plausible explanation for this rather strange behavior.
And what did they find? I'm guessing it's not alien megastructures.
Well, the findings presented by a team of astronomers from around the globe indicate that what we are seeing is an enormous cloud of dust with an orbit of around 700 days.
So it's just dirt, right? How do we know this?
Well, astronomers looked at the star in the visible ultraviolet and infrared wavelengths and discovered a signature that indicates small particles of dust, but in a huge cloud. And it seems they are responsible for causing this dimming.
Ah, so I guess this rules out aliens, huh?
We are 99.9% sure that this isn't aliens, but what it does present is a possibility that is just as mysterious. This cloud of dust may once have been a rocky planet like the Earth, but somehow it's been completely destroyed. The source of this devastation is yet to be discovered, and it will probably be up to the next generation of telescopes to lead the way.
Well, let's hope we're all still citizens of the Earth at that time when we can learn about the story. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you for that interesting update.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
Earlier in the show, we looked at a mysterious concrete bridge over the Leaky Leaky Highway, which led to a private family property. The bridge linked the family's house to Upper Kalihi Street, and a detective was killed on it in the 1960s when trying to catch a glimpse of a member of the family. In 1971, people again trespassed onto the private property, this time to poach Christmas trees. Now nobody lives there, and the bridge is not suitable to drive over anymore. Some hikers crossed the bridge when headed toward the Bowman Trail, and at one point in the 1990s, the state looked at the environmental impacts of transmitting and receiving antennas for cellular devices on the structure. The bridge is the Burmeister Overpass. It was named after the Burmeister family that owned the land. And our friend Mike May knew the answer. Congratulations. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. You can't look at what has been happening in Puerto Rico these past weeks without wondering how Hawaii's far more isolated islands would fare in a similar disaster. We often hear that our supplies of food and essentials would last 30 days at most if our islands were cut off for any reason. It's an accident of geography that makes Vern Miyagi's job especially challenging. He's the administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, and he's with us on the phone. Good morning, Vern.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you guys.
Well, I think it's kind of a good time to talk about this, don't you?
Yes, very much so.
You know, Puerto Rico is not, in fact, in the middle of the ocean, as it was described recently, but we are, right?
That's absolutely correct.
So what does that mean for us? You know, we've had, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Iniki the most violent hurricane that ever made landfall in the U.S., I mean, in terms of the wind speed?
Well, I think Iniki was Cat 4.
I think we might have just lost you, Vern. It sounds as if your phone cut off. But my recollection in terms of it, I was of course, here during Hurricane Iniki, was that the sustained winds that Iniki brought to it were among the highest ever recorded. We're getting Vern back on the line. He is the administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. And, of course, what we've been hearing about Puerto Rico is the difficulty of getting needed supplies there to an island that is anything but remote and extremely close to the U.S. mainland. So what, in the event of a similar emergency, would happen here? And the reason I brought up Hurricane Iniki, of course, is that Hurricane Iniki was a disaster from which Kauai took quite a while to recover. I'm speaking with Vern Miyagi, administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, about Hawaii's resident readiness for a similar hurricane to what Puerto Rico has been experiencing. Good morning again, Vern. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. Sorry about the connection there.
That's quite all right. Well, it's kind of an example of infrastructure and how fragile it can be, right? And I use the example of Hurricane Iniki because it is one of the more powerful hurricanes that America has ever had, and it took a long time to bounce back from Iniki, didn't it?
That's correct. When we deployed, we were there for about 6 weeks, about 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah. How much help did we get from the outside world, and how much help did we need from the outside world in a case like Iniki?
Well, Iniki was a major disaster, as you know. We got a lot of support from the active military. We got a lot of support from FEMA, the mm-hmm. federal forces.
Mm-hmm.
And we also rallied among the colonies, the Big Island help, Oahu help, Maui help, the people on Kauai. But it was a major effort involving both federal, state, and local resources.
And in a way, it's not an exact parallel to Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico is only one island as opposed to several, and we were able to help nearby islands with our resources, right?
That's correct. It was a beautiful example of the Aloha spirit, where the Hawaii people just help each other out.
Yeah,
take care of each other.
Well, you know, let's just sort of postulate the idea of a disaster that affects all the islands so that we all need help at the same time. How would it come our way?
Well, the main thing would be this would be a disaster at that level. Again, it would be a federally declared disaster, and we would need support from the federal sources. One important thing is that Hawaii is fortunate in that we have a major military headquarters here from active duty forces.
Uh-huh.
So they would be also calling in on their federal side to provide support to the state.
Do they have it sort of built into their mandate to, not just take care of what's on bases, but to take care of the surrounding civilian population as well?
Yes, that's the very fortunate part on our side. The relationships between the civilian side and the military side are very outstanding. FEDCOM and the federal forces have a Title 10 federal mission in the Pacific EOR area of responsibility.
Uh-huh.
However, they also have a secondary mission to provide what we call DISCA, DSCA, defense support to civil authorities.
Uh-huh.
And that's where we have our entry to their support.
And that's, of course, that's a lot of support. That's a lot of resources. That sounds as if that's kind of our saving grace, given the challenge of our isolation, Vern.
I believe so. And the other point to be made is that the dependents of the military, active duty military, live among us. So at the state side and the county side, we still have the same responsibility to make sure we take care of their families also.
Yeah. How's the, how's the funding pool for, you know, we established a hurricane fund after Iniki, right?
Yes.
It's been bit into a few times, but how are our resources financially for anticipating or dealing with the disaster?
Well, right now we have sufficient funding at the state level to handle emergencies. What we have to make sure is that we have the relationships with FEMA and the federal side so that if there is a disaster within Hawaii that qualifies for a presidential declaration, that we have that in hand right away, because the federal side would provide 75% with a 25% match from the state. So we have to make sure we account for that properly.
And that's always a key thing in a disaster when that federal announcement comes in, right?
That's correct.
And that unleashes a great deal of work.
That's right.
Are you, what would be your druthers if you were sort of given free hand to enhance what Hawaii already has in terms of disaster preparation? What kind of things would you be thinking about?
Well, you know, bottom line for me, Chris, is that our resilience or our preparedness is really based on individual and public preparedness. So if the public would take the recommendation seriously, and this Puerto Rico event is really an eye-opener again, or an awakening, that it's individual resilience that has to carry us forward initially. So people taking care of themselves, so that emergency management personnel like ourselves in the county can focus on getting the power back up, the roads back up, the harbors back open, and back to some sort of normalcy. You know, we have areas of the shelters, the tyranny of distance, as you mentioned earlier, and this is the kind of stuff that we have to get over with. But if the public can be resilient for that time frame, I think we'll be all right.
It really becomes a whole part of, gets right back on a whole sort of a cultural thing of how strong we are. Thanks very much, Vern. I really appreciate it, and I hope we don't have to talk to you again.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
No, thanks a lot for talking with us. I really appreciate it. Vern Miyagi is a retired United States Army Major General and Administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, two community groups sue the FAA over helicopter noise and regulations over Volcano National Park. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line, leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Join us tomorrow.